Welcome to Live from the Dark Room. My name is Andy Henderson. I am a photographer and a photography teacher, and each week I sit down with people on both sides of the camera to talk about the issues that matter to us most. I am so glad that you're joining us this week. It's a very special episode. Today I'm going to go through all of the questions that you've been asking on Facebook, Instagram, through emails, and I'm going to try to answer as many of them as I can in as much detail as I can. But before we get into it, you can follow the podcast at Photo Lessons by Andy on Instagram, or go to photolessonsbyandy.com to book a lesson. So without further ado, let's just get into the show. Hello, hello. Thank you for joining us. And by us, I mean me, because today is a little bit different. Today, I am going to be answering your questions, and I don't have a guest that I'm interviewing. And that's different than every episode so far. I've really enjoyed being able to sit down with a photographer or a model and talk to them about their photography journey, bounce ideas off of each other, ask questions. And today is different. Today is just me. So I put out on Facebook and Instagram a post asking for your questions, any photography-related questions that you would like asked on the podcast. I had gotten a few questions prior to that post and a few emails, and I wanted to open up the conversation for anyone who would want to have their questions answered. And that's what I'm going to do today. But before I get into your questions, I'm going to answer the question that I ask every guest at the beginning of every podcast, which is, if you had to use one lens for the rest of your life, what would it be and why? And it's funny because everybody has said the same thing so far. Every guest that I have interviewed has said that they would prefer to use a 50mm lens for the rest of their life. And I get it. It's a great lens. It's beautiful. It has great depth, especially, you know, you're shooting at even like 1.8, it's a great lens. It's versatile in a way it's versatile. I think my answer is going to be slightly different. I'm going to say the 24-70. And the reason that I'm going to say that is because of the versatility in focal length. I love being able to shoot at 24mm, architecture photography, travel photography, even certain street photography, I love shooting at 24. But, you know, if I had to, I could take headshots with it. It's not my first choice. My first choice for headshots is always going to be at least 105mm. But if I had to, you know, if this is the lens in this made-up scenario that I am using for the rest of my life, I could take almost everything that I need to. You know, I'm not going to be a sports photographer if I have to use a 24-70 for the rest of my life, but I could do the theater shots that I've been taking. I could do my studio work, most of it. I could do headshots. I could do architecture, travel, and I would say 24-70, 2.8 because of the versatility. I know that the Nikon version is what I use. The Tamron G2 is great. The Canon 2.8 is great. So I'm going to go a little against the grain here and say, for the first time ever on this show, the 24-70 2.8. So now that I have deeply frustrated some of you with that answer, I want to get into the questions that you've been asking. And if you have not asked a question yet and you have one, feel free to send me a DM on Instagram at Photo Lessons by Andy or on Facebook. You can also send me an email at livefromthedarkroom@gmail.com, and I will either answer it on the show or send you a response, probably both. And I want to answer your questions. This is what this is about. It's about photographers helping each other, learning from each other, and I would love for you to send me questions. Also, I would love it if you have someone that you want me to interview on this podcast. Send me their name, send me their contact info, and I would love to reach out and try to get in touch with them and see if they would be interested in being a guest on the show. So yeah, go ahead and do that too. So now to your questions, and there's not a specific way that I'm going to do this. I put them all in a Google Doc that I have in front of me, and I am just going to read straight down the list all of the questions. Let's just get into it. The first one I have is Mary on Instagram asked, how do you give your pictures to clients? That's a good question because there are so many different ways to do it. And I actually do three different things depending on the client. If I am doing something like weddings or family photos, engagement photos, things like that, typically what I will do is I am subscribed to a service called PixieSet. And they're not a sponsor, but it's called PixieSet, and they offer photo hosting on their website. They create beautiful galleries for all of your photos. So you send a client a link, they open the link, and it's a gallery. It's got a big picture at the top and it says their name on it. And then you scroll down and it's a customizable gallery that shows all of their photos and like previews of all of their photos. You can click on the photo, download groups of photos or individual photos. You can also buy prints straight from the site. So it's a really great hosting site if you want to. It's kind of like an industry standard for wedding photographers to have something like that. There are multiple sites that do that, but I use PixieSet. It's a little pricey, but there are also monthly plans that make it a little more affordable. And again, you set up like a Stripe account that links to your gallery and people can buy prints and you will receive money for all the prints that they buy as well that are not included in like printing costs or shipping costs. So that's one way. The second way is Dropbox. It's, you know, super simple. It's basic. It is, you know, cheaper than PixieSet to get like a 1 or 2 terabyte plan. And you send clients photos that way. I send people, when I was working on Broadway, that's how I would send all of my links to, the theater companies that I was shooting for was I would send them a Dropbox link. And it's super easy, it's secure, you can share it with specific people, and it's reasonably priced. That's the second way. The third way is sites like WeTransfer. They're kind of like a one-time sending thing. I mean, I think you have to create an account if you're going to send certain file sizes, but up to a certain amount, and I'm not sure what that amount is, you can send files straight to someone's email. It will say it's from your email and there's no account. The only issue that I have with sites like WeTransfer is that it does not store the files for more than like 30 days, I think. With Dropbox, it's in there and it's in there until you delete it. And even after you delete it, you have a deleted folder that you can restore within 30 days of it being deleted. But I like Dropbox. That's kind of my middle ground answer to that question because it's cheap, it's simple, and it's kind of industry standard for just photographers in general. So I hope that answered your question. It was funny, when I saw that question, I was reminded of how I used to do it when I was first starting out and first giving photos to clients, which was, and other photographers, you're going to cringe when you remember, we used to send things via CD. We would go to the store, buy a big mega pack of writable, readable CDs, and we would put the photos on them and then mail them to clients. And your clients had to wait multiple business days for their photos to get to them because they were on a CD. And God forbid a CD break in the mail and you have to do the process all over again. In terms of keeping photos secure, I would highly recommend double backing everything up to 2 different hard drives. That's not part of your question, but it's something that I just thought about as I'm going over this question. But, you know, it's a little bit more secure than CDs. I would say even, you know, Dropbox is more secure than a CD. Also, mailing photos via CD to clients is costly. You got to buy stamps and envelopes, and it's not cost or time effective. So be thankful that there are a lot more options now. The next question is from Christina, who asks, how do you take the perfect self-portrait? It depends. It depends a little bit on what you are classifying as the perfect self-portrait. If you're talking about headshots, I think the most important thing is lighting. And you know, self-portraits, I take a lot of self-portraits, but they're more artistic. I get creative with the lighting. I get creative with the backgrounds and the colors and the editing and all of that. But if you just want a really clean, nice headshot type self-portrait that you're wanting to put on for like a LinkedIn profile picture or a Facebook profile picture, something like that, I think the most important thing is to get clean and even lighting. So what that means is that you don't have multiple color temperatures in your lighting. An example of that would be you don't want the lighting from your apartment lights and the sun, because those are going to be two different color temperatures. You don't want two different LED light colors on you. If you know, you really want to find a window is what I would say, and get in front of that window and get that good lighting on your face. Make sure there's no weird shadows and make sure that the light is always coming from above you, which is really important and, you know, easy to do with natural lighting because the light is always above you. But you don't want light to be coming from below because that creates weird shadows on top of your nose, on top of your eyes, above your lips, and it looks really, really unnatural. If you don't believe me, just take your phone flashlight, go stand in front of your mirror and put the flashlight under your chin and show me what kind of shadows. You know, it's the classic campfire, scary story, flashlight under the chin look. And that's not what anybody wants. Lighting at least a little bit above you. You want clean, even lighting, one source of lighting, one color, I mean. And really just make sure that you're not cutting off your head. You also, if you're taking a headshot, you want at least the shoulders in. You don't want to cut off at the neck because it kind of makes you just look like a floating head. And those are really just basic composition principles, but they're going to be really important if you are taking a headshot. Hope that answers your question. Kyle asks, what are your opinions on Leica? For those of you that don't know, Leica is a camera brand, and they make film and digital cameras. They are very expensive. In fact, let me just go ahead and look up the Leica Q2. The Leica Q2 camera is running about $5,000 right now when I'm just looking it up on B&H, Adorama, Amazon. B&H, it is $5,000, and that is for 47.3 megapixels. That's a full-frame sensor. You've got a 28mm 1.7 lens that comes with it. Here is my issue with Leica. I don't think the product justifies the price point that it's set at. And I want to explain what I mean by that, because the Leica Q2 is a very good camera. It's not a bad camera by any means. It's a really good camera. The issue that I have is that it's $5,000. And if you're going to be spending that much on a camera, it's almost kind of just to be like, hey, I have a Leica camera. Because if you're wanting it for the practical use of taking photos, the Nikon D850 and the Canon 5D Mark IV, which are the Leica Q2 equivalents, are going to outperform that Leica every single time in almost every category. I think the only advantage that the Leica has over the D850 and the 5D Mark IV is I think it shoots 20 frames a second in continuous shooting mode, whereas the Nikon and Canon shoot like 7 to 9 or something like that. But again, well, for me, I'm never going to shoot 20 frames a second, even when I'm shooting sports. But the issue that I have is that it's not anywhere close to being a superior camera to the industry standard Canon and Nikons. Like, it has way less focus points. It has, it only goes up to 1/2000th of a second for your max shutter speed. Whereas the Nikon and Canon go to 1/8000th of a second. The battery life is way less. You can only take 370 shots on the Leica Q2, whereas you can take 1,840 on the D850. You have headphone and microphone ports. You've got a higher dynamic range, better low light ISO. It's just an overall worse camera than cameras that are $3,000 cheaper. So like you have people who shoot with Leica and they're like, oh, it's the greatest thing in the world. But here's the deal. You can get better shots on a cheaper camera. You can also buy a lens and a camera, if not two brand new lenses and a brand new camera, for the same price that you would be paying for that camera and the lens that it comes with. So, I mean, if you have the money, go for it. Why not? Who am I to tell you how to spend your money? But from a practical standpoint, the industry standard for Nikon and Canon are much better cameras. Mark asked, what has been the trickiest project you've done that has helped you grow? That is a really good question. There are a few things that come to mind, a few projects that I've worked on, or personal projects, things like that, that I have completed that I feel like were really impactful on my photography career. But the one that immediately comes to mind might be funny, but it's actually learning how to take headshots of Kinsey, my wife. When we were first dating, she needed headshots, and I took some headshots of her, and they were terrible. They were really, really bad. And I knew that this was going to be something that she would need in the future, so I wanted to get better at it. And so I learned slowly over time kind of the basics of good headshots. And I really took some time. I took a photography masterclass on headshots. I took a couple of Photoshop tutorials. And I really tried to teach myself how to best learn how to light, shoot, and edit and retouch a headshot. And from that, I learned a lot about lighting. From that, I learned a lot about retouching. From that, I learned a lot about posing and things like that. And it has really helped me grow in a lot of different aspects of photography. But specifically now, headshots, which is great because I take a lot of headshots for a lot of actors. And it's really helped me learn how to set up, pose, light, and retouch headshots. And you asked, what has been the trickiest project you've done that's helped you grow? It's taken probably 2 years of learning and not being good at it. And that has definitely been the trickiest project because I'm still learning. And I don't think I'll ever stop learning, but I'm still learning how to properly shoot headshots. And I think it's definitely something that I am going to continue growing with, but it's definitely been fun and it has definitely helped me grow. So yeah, that's what I would say for that. Mary asked, what makes a good photo? Mary, I don't know. I'm going to level with you. I don't know. There are a lot of factors and art is subjective. It's very subjective. Photography is very subjective. I could take a photo and someone might say, that's a great photo. And someone else might say, that's a terrible photo. There are rules to photography and there are ways in which a majority of people would say that is a good photo or that is a bad photo. But overall, it's just art. It's like anything. It is a means of expression and it is a way in which artists show emotions and feelings and their thoughts and expressions. And so I think what makes a good photo, I don't know. It's in focus, that the shutter speed is set correctly, so you know there's not motion, unless that's what you want to do. And again, that's another thing, is like you can break these rules intentionally. There are some really great out-of-focus shots. There are some really great under- and overexposed shots. So like, again, what makes a good photo? I'm going to have to pass. I'm going to have to pull that card and just pass, because there are some really bad photos that I think are really good. Larissa asked, anything in Photoshop, which I'm just taking to mean, how do I do anything in Photoshop? And forgive me if that's not what you were asking, but that's what I'm going to go for. And to answer that question, I would say Photoshop is a beast for sure. And if you don't have a lot of experience with it, it can be very intimidating. It is an Adobe product, so if you are using Lightroom, there are some things that transfer over, but Lightroom and Photoshop are very, very different. And Photoshop is layers-based, and so it's a completely different experience than anything you would be doing in Lightroom. I think the easiest way to go about getting better at Photoshop is watching tutorials. There are so many Photoshop tutorials on YouTube, and some of them are bad. Some of them are not good, but even the bad ones are going to teach you how to use the tools, hopefully. If you subscribe to Skillshare, there are some really great Skillshare instructors that will take you through all of the basics of Photoshop and teach you everything that you need to know about every single tool and feature in Photoshop. They're like 40-hour long classes, and you can do Skillshare for like 10 bucks a month. So again, Skillshare, not a sponsor, but if you want to be, I'm right here. So that's what I would say. Take tutorials, watch videos, and just be patient. Photoshop is not something you can learn in a day, but the more you practice, the more you learn, the better you'll become. Just like anything. Hope that answers your question. Juliana asked, what are your tips on making someone feel good and confident in front of the camera? Great question. So if you haven't listened to the episode that I did with Cody Giles, I believe it was episode 2, then I would highly recommend going back and listening to that. We got into a really, really good discussion on how he makes his subjects comfortable in front of the lens, ways that he evokes emotion out of his subjects, and it's a really good starting point. But kind of to sum it up, I think something that's really important to do is to make sure that you're connecting in a way with your subject, whether that be telling a joke at the beginning of the shoot or trying to connect with them in some way, like maybe you both listen to the same musical artist or have recently seen the same movie or TV show. I think just talking with them and starting natural, genuine conversations and getting to know people, asking them questions is really, really important because you want to get to know your subjects. You know, you don't want to just be like, okay, here, you're here for the shoot. Let's just stand here and let me just go ahead and take these pictures of you. And we're not going to talk other than, you know, talking about photos. It makes the whole experience a lot less stiff. And really just asking questions, getting to know your subjects is really important. And I've had a lot of experience with having to get to know subjects on the day of the shoot, you know, not really talking to anybody other than over the phone or via email before the shoot. And so, yeah, normally I would just ask a lot of questions, see what they were into, what music they liked, what movies they liked, things like that. Basic questions, just getting to know your subjects is really, really important. That will help them loosen up, feel more confident. And also just like Cody said in episode 2, show them the back of the camera, show them what you are creating and just encourage them and be their biggest cheerleader to what shots that you're able to get, you know, be like, man, this is such a good shot. Look at this. And you know, that helps as well. So hope that answers your question. Will asked, describe your perfect shoot. And then in parentheses, he put equipment, location, subject, climate, Spotify playlist. This is a great question. For me, there isn't really a perfect shoot. I enjoy unpredictability in kind of what I'm getting myself into. You know, when I was managing a photo studio in New York, I had, you know, surround sound speakers, and I had really cool lighting and couches and food and snacks and coffee and things like that. And I really was in full control over the atmosphere of the shoot. But I kind of like, you know, the on location, like get the shots with the lighting that you have, like figure it out, like figure out ways to make things unique and beautiful and just capture those moments wherever you are. And I don't know, for me, I just try to make the most of whatever shoot I'm getting myself into. And so if that means I have everything under control and I am in control of everything like I was in the studio, then great. I'll make the most out of it. I'll probably throw on some Leon Bridges, something like that, and just have a really good time, dance a little bit, have like low lighting, and just have fun with it. But you know, if I'm out and I'm shooting in the field doing something like that, I'll make the most of it too. So yeah, make the most of what you have, I guess, is the answer to that question. Rachel asked, how do you use a zoom lens indoors for live shots? This is a very good question because a lot of zoom lenses that people use if they're first starting out or if it's all that they currently have are going to not be fixed aperture lenses. It's not going to be a 70 to 200 2.8. You're going to have like a 3.5 to 5.6 or something like that. And it's going to make it a lot harder to shoot in low light. You know, you've got aperture, ISO, and shutter speed. You've got to use those three things to get correct lighting. But the issue is, if you don't really have control over your aperture and it's going up to 5.6 because that's the lowest that you can get at like 300 millimeters with your lens, your shutter speed is going to have to be really, really low, or your ISO is going to have to be really, really high. And it's tricky. It really is. When I was shooting tennis at the university that I went to, a lot of their tennis matches were played indoors, and it was just horrible lighting, just terrible, very dark. I don't even know how the players saw the ball. But besides all that, I was using a lens that I could only shoot at 200 millimeters at 5.6. And so I was having so much trouble getting shots because it's action, right? Tennis, you know, they're running back and forth, they're swinging the rackets, and the ball is flying, and you want to freeze that motion. So my ISO was bumped up really, really high, and a lot of the shots were grainy. I think that is tricky. That is a very tricky question, because if you don't have the proper equipment, and I like to say that you can get great shots with whatever equipment you have, and I stand by that. But the issue is, if you're shooting something specific like sports indoors or something with low lighting that is also very motion heavy, you really do need to have equipment that you are able to stop down your aperture to like 2.8 even. And sometimes 2.8 is even pretty dark. So I know that's not really the answer that you probably wanted to hear, but if you aren't able to work with what you have to make your shutter speed and ISO work, then you might have to buy like a 2.8 fixed zoom lens, like a 70 to 200 2.8, if that's what you're shooting. The last question that I have for this podcast is from Bethany, who asked, how did you work on composition? I shot so much when I was first starting out. I took pictures of anything and everything. It didn't matter if it was interesting. I took pictures of the trees in my backyard. They were not good photos. I wasn't even taking pictures of the whole trees. I was just taking pictures of the trunks. And what I'm trying to say is practice. It's like anything. The way that I worked on composition was, again, I read books on photography composition. You learn things like the rule of thirds and not cutting off people's hands and feet and heads and things like that, but also just practicing and going out and taking 100 photos, coming back and then looking at them with a critical eye and thinking, okay, how can I get better? These are the composition rules that I have learned and I have taught myself. How can I improve? How could I have improved this shoot? How could I have improved these photos? I really think it may be cliche to say, but practice makes perfect. And the more that you go out and take photos, the better you'll become. Another way that I would highly recommend going about getting better at composition is to talk to other photographers. Send other photographers your work. It might be scary to put yourself out there like that, but being able to send photographers who you trust your work and having them give you critical feedback is really important to growing as a photographer. I think there is a difference between someone just trashing your work and someone giving you constructive criticism. So I think it's important to find someone who is willing to give you constructive criticism, and whether that's one person or a group of photographers. I'm in a group chat with photographers right now, and we critique our work, each other's work sometimes, and I think that's really important. And so if you can find other photographers to critique your work, give you constructive criticism, that will only help you improve as a photographer. So hope that answers your question. Those are all the questions that I got, and I'm so glad that I was able to get through all of them. This was so much fun. I had a blast answering your questions. I really hope that if you asked a question and I answered it, that you were able to learn a little bit about it. If you want more information, feel free to send me a message, send me an email, send me a DM, whatever it is you want to do. I would be happy to go into more detail on your questions. If you have new questions that weren't answered in this episode, feel free to shoot those over to me as well. And I cannot wait to do this again because I just love answering your questions. I love the questions that you asked. They were really, really great. If you want to ask another question, feel free to send it to livefromthedarkroom@gmail.com or send us a DM at photolessonsbyandy on Instagram. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next week on Live from the Dark Room.